Chapter 26. Reproach to the painter, for I have a suspicion that these great men, who were, of necessity, very much in the hands of monks and priests, painted monks and priests a great deal too often. I frequently see, in pictures of real power, heads quite below the story and the painter. And I invariably observe that those heads are of the convent stamp, and have their counterparts among the convent inmates of this hour. So, I have settled with myself that, in such cases, the lameness was not with the painter, but with the vanity and ignorance of certain of his employers, who would be apostles on canvas, at all events. The exquisite grace and beauty of Canova's statues, the wonderful gravity and repose of many of the ancient works in sculpture, both in the Capitol and the Vatican, and the strength and fire of many others, are, in their different ways, beyond all reach of words. They are especially impressive and delightful, after the works of Bernini and his disciples, in which the churches of Rome, from St. Peter's downward, abound, and which are, I verily believe, the most detestable class of productions in the wide world. I would infinitely rather, as mere works of art, look upon the three deities of the past, the present, and the future, in the Chinese collection, than upon the best of these breezy maniacs, whose every fold of drapery is blown inside out, whose smallest vein, or artery, is as big as an ordinary forefinger, whose hair is like a nest of lively snakes, and whose attitudes put all other extravagance to shame. Insomuch that I do honestly believe, there can be no place in the world, where such intolerable abortions, begotten of the sculptor's chisel, are to be found in such profusion, as in Rome. There is a fine collection of Egyptian antiquities, in the Vatican, and the ceilings of the rooms in which they are arranged, are painted to represent a starlight sky in the desert. It may seem an odd idea, but it is very effective. The grim, half-human monsters from the temples look more grim and monstrous underneath the deep dark blue. It sheds a strange, uncertain, gloomy air on everything, a mystery adapted to the objects, and you leave them, as you find them, shrouded in a solemn night. In the private palaces, pictures are seen to the best advantage. There are seldom so many in one place that the attention need become distracted, or the eye confused. You see them very leisurely, and are rarely interrupted by a crowd of people. There are portraits innumerable, by Titian, and Rembrandt, and Van Dyck, heads by Guido, and Domenichino, and Carlo Dolci, various subjects by Correggio, and Murillo, and Raffle, and Salvator Rosa, and Spagnoletto, many of which it would be difficult, indeed, to praise too highly, or to praise enough, such is their tenderness and grace, their noble elevation, purity, and beauty. The portrait of Beatrice di Cenci, in the Palazzo Berberini, is a picture almost impossible to be forgotten. Through the transcendent sweetness and beauty of the face, there is a something shining out that haunts me. I see it now, as I see this paper, or my pen. The head is loosely draped in white, the light hair falling down below the linen folds. She has turned suddenly towards you, and there is an expression in the eyes, although they are very tender and gentle, as if the wildness of a momentary terror or distraction had been struggled with and overcome that instant, and nothing but a celestial hope and a beautiful sorrow and a desolate earthly helplessness remained. Some stories say that Guido painted it the night before her execution. Some other stories, that he painted it from memory, after having seen her, on her way to the scaffold. I am willing to believe that, as you see her on his canvas, so she turned towards him, in the crowd, from the first sight of the axe, and stamped upon his mind a look which he has stamped on mine, as though I had stood beside him in the concourse. The guilty palace of the Cenci, blighting a whole quarter of the town, as it stands withering away by grains. Had that face, to my fancy, in its dismal porch, and at its black, blind windows, and flitting up and down its dreary stairs, and growing out of the darkness of the ghostly galleries. The history is written in the painting, written, in the dying girl's face, by nature's own hand. And oh, how in that one touch she puts to flight, instead of making kin, the puny world, that claimed to be related to her, in right of poor conventional forgeries. I saw in the Palazzo Spada, the statue of Pompey, the statue at whose base Caesar fell. A stern, tremendous figure. I imagined one of greater finish, of the last refinement, full of delicate touches, losing its distinctness, in the giddy eyes of one whose blood was ebbing before it, and settling into some such rigid majesty as this, as death came creeping over the upturned face. The excursions in the neighborhood of Rome are charming, and would be full of interest were it only for the changing views they afford, of the wild Campagna. But, every inch of ground, in every direction, is rich in associations, and in natural beauties. There is Albano, with its lovely lake and wooded shore, and with its wine, that certainly has not improved since the days of Horace, and in these times hardly justifies his panegyric. There is squalid Tivoli, with the river Anio, diverted from its course, and plunging down, headlong, some 80 feet in search of it. With its picturesque temple of the Sibyl, perched high on a crag, its minor waterfalls glancing and sparkling in the sun, and one good cavern yawning darkly, where the river takes a fearful plunge and shoots on, low down under beetling rocks. There, too, is the Villa d'Este, deserted and decaying among groves of melancholy pine and cypress trees, where it seems to lie in state. Then, there is Frascati, and, on the steep above it, the ruins of Tusculum, where Cicero lived, and wrote, and adorned his favorite house. Some fragments of it may yet be seen there, and where Cato was born. We saw its ruined amphitheater on a gray, dull day, when a shrill March wind was blowing, and when the scattered stones of the old city lay strewn about the lonely eminence, as desolate and dead as the ashes of a long-extinguished fire. One day we walked out, a little party of three, to Albano, 14 miles distant, possessed by a great desire to go there by the ancient Appian Way, long since ruined and overgrown. We started at 7:30 in the morning, and within an hour or so were out upon the open Campagna. For 12 miles we went climbing on, over an unbroken succession of mounds, and heaps, and hills, of ruin. Tombs and temples, overthrown and prostrate. Small fragments of columns, friezes, pediments. Great blocks of granite and marble, moldering arches, grass-grown and decayed. Ruin enough to build a spacious city from, lay strewn about us. Sometimes, loose walls, built up from these fragments by the shepherds, came across our path. Sometimes, a ditch between two mounds of broken stones, obstructed our progress. Sometimes, the fragments themselves, rolling from beneath our feet, made it a toilsome matter to advance, but it was always ruin. Now, we tracked a piece of the old road, above the ground, now traced it, underneath a grassy covering, as if that were its grave, but all the way was ruin. In the distance, ruined aqueducts went stalking on their giant course along the plain, and every breath of wind that swept towards us stirred early flowers and grasses, springing up, spontaneously, on miles of ruin. The unseen larks above us, who alone disturbed the awful silence, had their nests in ruin, and the fierce herdsmen, clad in sheepskins, who now and then scowled out upon us from their sleeping nooks, were housed in ruin. The aspect of the desolate Campagna in one direction, where it was most level, reminded me of an American prairie, but what is the solitude of a region, where men have never dwelt, to that of a desert, where a mighty race have left their footprints in the earth from which they have vanished, where the resting places of their dead have fallen like their dead, and the broken hourglass of time is but a heap of idle dust. Returning, by the road, at sunset, and looking, from the distance, on the course we had taken in the morning, I almost feel as I had felt, when I first saw it, at that hour, as if the sun would never rise again, but looked its last, that night, upon a ruined world. To come again on Rome, by moonlight, after such an expedition, is a fitting close to such a day. The narrow streets, devoid of footways, and choked, in every obscure corner, by heaps of dunghill rubbish, contrast so strongly, in their cramped dimensions, and their filth, and darkness, with the broad square before some haughty church, in the center of which, a hieroglyphic-covered obelisk, brought from Egypt in the days of the emperors, looks strangely on the foreign scene about it, or perhaps an ancient pillar, with its honored statue overthrown, supports a Christian saint, Marcus Aurelius giving place to Paul, and Trajan to Saint Peter. Then, there are the ponderous buildings reared from the spoliation of the Colosseum, shutting out the moon, like mountains, while here and there are broken arches and rent walls, through which it gushes freely, as the life comes pouring from a wound. The little town of miserable houses, walled and shut in by barred gates, is the quarter where the Jews are locked up nightly, when the clock strikes eight, a miserable place, densely populated, and reeking with bad odors, but where the people are industrious and money-getting. In the daytime, as you make your way along the narrow streets, you see them all at work. Upon the pavement, oftener than in their dark and frowsy shops, furbishing old clothes, and driving bargains. Crossing from these patches of thick darkness, out into the moon once more, the fountain of Trevi, welling from 100 jets, and rolling over mimic rocks, is silvery to the eye and ear. In the narrow little throat of street, beyond, a booth, dressed out with flaring lamps, and boughs of trees, attracts a group of sulky Romans round its smoky coppers of hot broth, and cauliflower stew, its trays of fried fish, and its flasks of wine. As you rattle round the sharply twisting corner, a lumbering sound is heard. The coachman stops abruptly, and uncovers, as a van comes slowly by, preceded by a man who bears a large cross, by a torchbearer, and a priest, the latter chanting as he goes. It is the dead cart, with the bodies of the poor, on their way to burial in the sacred field outside the walls, where they will be thrown into the pit, that will be covered with a stone tonight, and sealed up for a year. But whether, in this ride, you pass by obelisks, or columns, ancient temples, theaters, houses, porticos, or forums, it is strange to see how every fragment, whenever it is possible, has been blended into some modern structure, and made to serve some modern purpose: a wall, a dwelling place, a granary, a stable, some use for which it never was designed, and associated with which it cannot otherwise than lamely assort. It is stranger still to see how many ruins of the old mythology, how many fragments of obsolete legend and observance, have been incorporated into the worship of Christian altars here, and how, in numberless respects, the false faith and the true are fused into a monstrous union. From one part of the city, looking out beyond the walls, a squat and stunted pyramid, the burial place of Caius Cestius, makes an opaque triangle in the moonlight. But, to an English traveler, it serves to mark the grave of Shelley too, whose ashes lie beneath the little garden near it. Nearer still, almost within its shadow, lie the bones of Keats, whose name is writ in water, apostrophe that shines brightly in the landscape of a calm Italian night. The Holy Week in Rome is supposed to offer great attractions to all visitors. But, saving for the sights of Easter Sunday, I would counsel those who go to Rome for its own interest, to avoid it at that time. The ceremonies, in general, are of the most tedious and wearisome kind, the heat and crowd at every one of them, painfully oppressive, the noise, hubbub, and confusion, quite distracting. We abandoned the pursuit of these shows, very early in the proceedings, and betook ourselves to the ruins again. But, we plunged into the crowd for a share of the best of the sights, and what we saw, I will describe to you. At the Sistine Chapel, on the Wednesday, we saw very little, for by the time we reached it, though we were early, the besieging crowd had filled it to the door, and overflowed into the adjoining hall, where they were struggling, and squeezing, and mutually expostulating, and making great rushes every time a lady was brought out faint, as if at least 50 people could be accommodated in her vacant standing room. Hanging in the doorway of the chapel, was a heavy curtain, and this curtain, some 20 people nearest to it, in their anxiety to hear the chaunting of the miserere, were continually plucking at, in opposition to each other, that it might not fall down, and stifle the sound of the voices. The consequence was, that it occasioned the most extraordinary confusion, and seemed to wind itself about the unwary, like a serpent. Now, a lady was wrapped up in it, and couldn't be unwound. Now, the voice of a stifling gentleman was heard inside it, beseeching to be let out. Now, two muffled arms, no man could say of which sex, struggled in it as in a sack. Now, it was carried by a rush, bodily overhead into the chapel, like an awning. Now, it came out the other way, and blinded one of the Pope's Swiss guard, who had arrived, that moment, to set things to rights. Being seated at a little distance, among two or three of the Pope's gentlemen, who were very weary and counting the minutes as perhaps His Holiness was to we had better opportunities of observing this eccentric entertainment, than of hearing the miserere. Sometimes, there was a swell of mournful voices that sounded very pathetic and sad, and died away, into a low strain again, but that was all we heard. At another time, there was the exhibition of relics in St. Peter's, which took place at between 6 and 7 o'clock in the evening, and was striking from the cathedral, being dark and gloomy, and having a great many people in it. The place into which the relics were brought, one by one, by a party of three priests, was a high balcony near the chief altar. This was the only lighted part of the church. There are always 112 lamps burning near the altar, and there were two tall tapers, besides, near the black statue of St. Peter, but these were nothing in such an immense edifice. The gloom, and the general upturning of faces to the balcony, and the prostration of true believers on the pavement, as shining objects, like pictures or looking glasses, were brought out and shown, had something effective in it, despite the very preposterous manner in which they were held up for the general edification, and the great elevation at which they were displayed, which one would think rather calculated to diminish the comfort derivable from a full conviction of their being genuine. On the Thursday, we went to see the Pope convey the sacrament from the Sistine Chapel, to deposit it in the Cappella Palina, another chapel in the Vatican, a ceremony emblematical of the entombment of the Savior before His resurrection. We waited in a great gallery with a great crowd of people, three-fourths of them English, for an hour or so, while they were chaunting the miserere, in the Sistine Chapel again. Both chapels opened out of the gallery, and the general attention was concentrated on the occasional opening and shutting of the door of the one for which the Pope was ultimately bound. None of these openings disclosed anything more tremendous than a man on a ladder, lighting a great quantity of candles, but at each and every opening, there was a terrific rush made at this ladder and this man, something like, I should think, a charge of the heavy British cavalry at Waterloo. The man was never brought down, however, nor the ladder, for it performed the strangest antics in the world among the crowd, where it was carried by the man, when the candles were all lighted, and finally it was stuck up against the gallery wall, in a very disorderly manner, just before the opening of the other chapel, and the commencement of a new chant, announced the approach of His Holiness. At this crisis, the soldiers of the guard, who had been poking the crowd into all sorts of shapes, formed down the gallery, and the procession came up, between the two lines they made. There were a few choristers, and then a great many priests, walking two and two, and carrying the good-looking priests at least their lighted tapers, so as to throw the light with a good effect upon their faces. For the room was darkened. Those who were not handsome, or who had not long beards, carried their tapers anyhow, and abandoned themselves to spiritual contemplation. Meanwhile, the chanting was very monotonous and dreary. The procession passed on, slowly, into the chapel, and the drone of voices went on, and came on, with it, until the Pope himself appeared, walking under a white satin canopy, and bearing the covered sacrament in both hands. Cardinals and canons clustered round him, making a brilliant show. The soldiers of the guard knelt down as he passed. All the bystanders bowed, and so he passed on into the chapel. The white satin canopy being removed from over him at the door, and a white satin parasol hoisted over his poor old head, in place of it. A few more couples brought up the rear, and passed into the chapel also. Then, the chapel door was shut, and it was all over, and... Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.